This half-hour, one-half-credit CLE course is based on the civil procedure-related summaries of decisions released by our New York State appellate courts in January 2019 and posted that same month on the New York Appellate Digest website. The page references are to the January 2019 civil procedure update pamphlet, which is available on the site. In the first case, Soloway, on page 6, the first department illustrated the application of New York's borrowing statute at CPLR 202. The plaintiff, a New Jersey resident, brought a legal malpractice action against New York attorneys. The New Jersey statute of limitations is 6 years, and New York's is 3. The action was brought 3 years and 8 months after it accrued. Because the action was not timely under New York law, the complaint was properly dismissed. As the court explained it, the court correctly found the complaint time-barred under CPLR 202, New York's borrowing statute, which requires a claim to be timely under both the New York limitations period and that of the jurisdiction where the claim is alleged to have arisen. Plaintiff, a New Jersey resident, alleged legal malpractice in connection with defendant's representation of him for numerous real estate transactions, a cause of action which has a 3-year statute of limitations in New York under CPLR 214, subdivision 6, and a 6-year limitations period in New Jersey under New York statutes annotated section 2A:14-1. The latest that the alleged malpractice could have occurred was February 7, 2013, the date set for closing on the last of the real estate matters. Because plaintiff commenced the action on October 28, 2016, more than 3 years later, it was correctly dismissed as untimely. In Matter of New York Community Bank, on page 7, the First Department, in a case of first impression, held that the contents of a safe deposit box rented by two people, only one of whom was a judgment debtor, could be turned over to the judgment creditor. The action was an expedited special proceeding pursuant to CPLR 5225B. As the court explained it, CPLR 5225B provides for an expedited special proceeding by which a judgment creditor can recover money or other personal property belonging to a judgment debtor against a person in possession or custody of money or other personal property in which the judgment debtor has an interest in order to satisfy a judgment. When two or more persons open a bank account, making a deposit of cash, securities, or other property, a presumption of joint tenancy with right of survivorship arises. That's Banking Law Section 675B. If the presumption is applied, each named tenant is possessed of the whole of the account so as to make the account vulnerable to the levy of a money judgment by the judgment creditor of one of the joint tenants. By relying on the terms of the rental agreement, plaintiff met its burden of establishing the two renters as joint tenants with rights of survivorship of the safe deposit box account. The safe deposit box is controlled by each of them. Each of them has access to the box at all times, and each of them can deposit property into the box or remove property from it without each other's permission. Should either one of them die, the survivor would have access to the box and could remove all its contents. Therefore, although only one of the renters was a judgment debtor, the contents of the box were available to the judgment creditor. The next case, Metropolitan Bridge, on pages 8 and 9. The First Department found that the New York City Housing Authority had waived the attorney-client privilege for discovery purposes and was properly sanctioned by a $3,000 fine for refusing to turn over the documents. The case involved bids submitted to the Housing Authority. The Housing Authority alleged certain bids included fraudulent certifications stating that the parties had not been charged or convicted of a crime. But the plaintiff alleged the Housing Authority had been fully informed of the charges and still awarded the contracts. When the plaintiff sought discovery of the relevant documents, the Housing Authority asserted the attorney-client privilege because the law department had worked on the bids. As the court explained it, having placed the knowledge of its law department at issue, the Housing Authority waived attorney-client privilege. The Housing Authority cannot seek to prevent the disclosure of evidence showing that its attorneys recommended that the Housing Authority award the contracts to plaintiff despite knowing the operative facts. In addition, the Housing Authority may not rely on attorney-client privilege while selectively disclosing other self-serving privileged communications. The Housing Authority's conduct during discovery warranted sanctions, and it's not necessary to demonstrate willful and contumacious behavior in order to impose a sanction like a fine or preclusion, as opposed to a more drastic sanction, such as striking a pleading. In Melamed, on page 9, the Second Department held that plaintiff's motion to compel discovery of payroll records pursuant to CPLR 3124 should have been granted. The plaintiffs were seeking class certification for a labor lawsuit alleging underpayment of wages. The court explained, the defendants refused to provide material sought by the plaintiffs which was needed to determine whether the prerequisites of a class action set forth in CPLR 901A could be satisfied and to address the considerations set forth in CPLR 902 for determining whether the matter may proceed as a class action. The items of discovery sought are material and necessary to the determination of whether the plaintiffs will fairly and adequately protect the interests of the class. And again, in that case, the motion to compel discovery should have been granted. In the next case, Trotman, on page 10, the Second Department held that the city bus driver's personnel file was not discoverable in this personal injury case because the action was based on respondeat superior, not negligent hiring. Plaintiff alleged she was injured when she fell on the bus. The city acknowledged that the bus driver was acting within the scope of his employment at that time. As the court explained, generally, where an employee is acting within the scope of his or her employment, the employer is liable for the employee's negligence under a theory of respondeat superior, and a plaintiff may not proceed with a cause of action to recover damages for negligent hiring and retention. In light of the defendant's formal concession that the bus driver was acting within the scope of his employment when the accident occurred, the personnel records of the bus driver are not discoverable. Furthermore, the plaintiff failed to show any other basis to justify granting her request for the personnel records, as any prior acts of carelessness or incompetence of the defendant's employee would not be admissible at trial. Therefore, the additional discovery sought by the plaintiff is not relevant or reasonably calculated to lead to evidence relevant to the issue of the driver's alleged negligence. In Vasquez Santos, on page 11, the First Department held that the motion to compel access by a third-party data mining company to plaintiff's devices, email accounts, and social media accounts should have been granted. Plaintiff, who had been a semi-professional basketball player, alleged he could no longer play due to his injuries. He claimed that posted photos showing him playing basketball were taken before the accident. The court wrote, "Private social media information can be discoverable to the extent it contradicts or conflicts with a plaintiff's alleged restrictions, disabilities, and losses, and other claims. The access to plaintiff's accounts and devices is appropriately limited in time, that being only items posted or sent after the accident, and in subject matter, that being those items discussing or showing defendant engaging in basketball or other similar physical activities." And again, that was the ruling was that a data mining company could have access to these devices and email accounts and social media accounts. In U.S. Bank, on pages 11 and 12, the Second Department held that the affirmation made in front of a notary in Israel did not indicate it was made under penalty of perjury, and therefore it had no probative value and did not rebut the process server's affidavit in this foreclosure action. As the court put it, an affirmation from a person physically located outside the geographic boundaries of the United States must comply with the additional formalities of CPLR 2309C and must, in substance, affirm that the statement is true under penalties of perjury under the laws of New York. And it says to see CPLR 2106B. In the next case, it's on pages 12 and 13, LaSalle Bank. It's another foreclosure case. The Second Department noted that in the absence of extraordinary circumstances, a court should not dismiss a complaint sua sponte or on its own. The court explained, a court's power to dismiss a complaint sua sponte is to be used sparingly and only when extraordinary circumstances exist to warrant dismissal. Supreme Court was not presented with any extraordinary circumstances warranting sua sponte dismissal of this foreclosure complaint. In BAC Home Loans on page 13, another foreclosure action, the plaintiff bank did not demonstrate it had standing to bring the action. To have standing, a bank must have been in possession of the note at the time the action was started, and conclusory allegations will not be enough. As the court explained it, the loan servicer's affidavit, which asserted that the named plaintiff was in possession of the note at the time of commencement of this action, provided no specifics as to the date of delivery or the date of commencement. The plaintiff's conclusory assertion as to possession on the date of commencement is insufficient to establish standing. In U.S. Bank, on pages 14 and 15, another foreclosure case, the Second Department, overruling some prior decisions, held that a defendant in a foreclosure action does not raise the bank's lack of standing as a defense simply by denying that the bank holds the note and mortgage in the answer. As the court put it, the issue of standing is waived absent some affirmative statement on the part of the mortgage foreclosure defendant, which need not invoke magic words or strictly adhere to any ritualistic formulation, but which must clearly, unequivocally, and expressly place the defense of lack of standing in issue by specifically identifying it in the answer or in a pre-answer motion to dismiss. A mere denial of factual allegations will not suffice for this purpose. If a defendant in a foreclosure action genuinely believes that she or he has a basis upon which to contest standing, it is not too much to ask her or him to specifically and affirmatively assert that position in the answer as the CPLR requires. U.S. Bank Trust on pages 16 and 17, another foreclosure case. The Third Department held that Bank's proof of standing, although not conclusory, failed to demonstrate actual possession of the note when the action was commenced. The court explained, plaintiff failed to demonstrate that it has standing as the assignee of the mortgage from MERS or MERS. By its express terms, the initial written assignment from MERS only assigns the mortgage, not the note, and no proof was submitted establishing that MERS was ever conferred with the requisite authority to assign the note. Merely attaching the note with a blank endorsement to the complaint is not sufficient for plaintiff to meet its prima facie burden on the issue of standing or to prove plaintiff's possessory interest in the note. Proof of actual possession is required. Plaintiff similarly failed to establish its standing by demonstrating that it had physical possession of the note at the time of the commencement of the action. In support of its motion for summary judgment, plaintiff submitted, among other things, a copy of its complaint, the mortgage, the unpaid note endorsed in blank, the relevant assignments of the mortgage, and proof of defendant's default. Plaintiff also tendered the affidavit of the authorized officer for Caliber Home Loans Incorporated, the mortgage loan servicing agent and attorney in fact for plaintiff. The affidavit of the authorized officer indicates the source of her knowledge to be her review of the electronic records. Other than alleging that she reviewed these electronic records, the authorized officer's affidavit fails to provide any indication that she actually examined the original note, nor did it provide any details with regard to whether plaintiff ever obtained possession thereof, and if so, how and when it came into its possession. The complaint is equivocal and alleges in the alternative that plaintiff is the current owner and holder of the subject mortgage and note, or has been delegated the authority to institute a mortgage foreclosure action by the owner and holder of the subject note and mortgage. Such language is insufficient to establish that plaintiff had physical possession of the note at the time it commenced the action. Okay, at this point, I'm going to insert the verification code, which you should place on the form to prove that you listened to this podcast. The verification code for this January 2019 Civil Procedure Update CLE is standing, the word standing. Again, the verification code for this January 2019 Update CLE is standing. Moving on to the next case, DK Property on pages 17 and 18. This is a breach of an insurance contract case stemming from the settling of a building. The First Department held there is no heightened pleading requirement for consequential damages in this type of insurance breach of contract action. As the court put it, the complaint alleges that rather than pay the claim, defendant has made unreasonable and increasingly burdensome information demands throughout the three-year period since the property damage occurred. Plaintiff contends defendant's investigatory process has taken so long and become so attenuated that the structural damage to the building has worsened. Among the consequential damages alleged are engineering costs, painting, repairs, monitoring equipment, moisture abatement to address water intrusion, loss of rents, and other expenses attributable to mitigating further damage to the property. A plaintiff may sue for consequential damages resulting from an insurer's failure to provide coverage if such damages, in parentheses risks, were foreseen or should have been foreseen when the contract was made. Here, plaintiff's allegations meet the pleading requirements of the CPLR with respect to consequential damages. There is no heightened pleading standard requiring plaintiff to explain or describe how and why the specific categories of consequential damages alleged were reasonable and foreseeable at the time of the contract. In the Garby case, on page 18, the Second Department noted that although CPLR 4106 gives a judge the power to discharge a juror and replace with an alternate, even after deliberations have begun, the judge should not do so without an inquiry. As the court explained it, in determining whether discharge and replacement of a juror is appropriate, a trial court must, after receiving notice that a juror may not be able to perform his or her duty, make whatever inquiry is reasonably necessary to determine whether the juror should be discharged and replaced with an alternate. In this medical malpractice action, the Supreme Court received a note during deliberations that a juror cannot come to a fair decision due to emotional distress. The court, however, refused to conduct any inquiry as to the nature of the juror's difficulty and refused even to speak to the juror individually. Instead, over objection, it excused the juror and seated an alternate. The court's failure to make an adequate inquiry was error, requiring a new trial. In Matiker of Boniker Properties and Pestel, on pages 19 and 20, these are a couple more sua sponte cases. The courts noted that the judges should not have dismissed causes of action without a demand for dismissal from a party, and should not have dismissed on a ground not raised by the parties. In Boniker, the court wrote, in the absence of a dispositive motion addressed to the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th causes of action, which sought declaratory relief and damages not in the nature of CPLR Article 78 relief, the Supreme Court should not have, in effect, dismissed those causes of action. In a hybrid proceeding and action, separate procedural rules apply to those causes of action which are asserted pursuant to CPLR Article 78, on the one hand, and those to recover damages and for declaratory relief on the other hand. The Supreme Court may not employ the summary procedure applicable to a CPLR Article 78 cause of action to dispose of causes of action to recover damages or seeking declaratory relief. Thus, where no party makes a request for a summary determination of the causes of action which seek to recover damages or declaratory relief, it is error for the Supreme Court to summarily dispose of those causes of action. And in the Pestel case, the court explained, the Supreme Court should not have granted defense motion for summary judgment on a ground not raised in the defendant's motion. On a motion for summary judgment, the court is limited to the issues or defenses that are the subject of the motion before the court. The plaintiff had no opportunity to address the issue regarding the allegedly defective summons, and this lack of notice and opportunity to be heard implicates the fundamental issue of fairness that is the cornerstone of due process. IBAR, on pages 21 and 22, is an important case. The Second Department held that a foreign corporation's registration with the Department of State to appoint an agent for service of process does not constitute consent to the general jurisdiction of New York courts. Here, plaintiff, a New York resident, was in a rollover accident in Pennsylvania and sued Goodyear, the tire manufacturer, and Ford, the vehicle manufacturer, alleging the products were defective. The plaintiffs did not allege long-arm jurisdiction. Neither the vehicle nor the tire was manufactured or purchased from the defendants in New York. The plaintiff had purchased the vehicle from a New York non-party and had used the vehicle in New York. As the court explained it, we conclude that a corporate defendant's registration to do business in New York and designation of the Secretary of State to accept service of process in New York does not constitute consent by the corporation to submit to the general jurisdiction of New York for causes of action that are unrelated to the corporation's affiliations with New York. In Archer, on pages 21 and 22, the Third Department found that plaintiff had presented sufficient evidence of the criteria for a long-arm jurisdiction to warrant discovery. Plaintiff's decedent was killed when a heavy bridge form manufactured by Spillman fell on him as the form was being unloaded from a truck in New York. The court explained, plaintiff alleged that while operating outside the state, Spillman launched a force or instrument of harm by negligently designing, creating, supplying, and distributing to customers a defective nesting diagram depicting how to load and unload a bridge form on and off a flatbed trailer, and that such negligence caused decedent's injuries within the state. Plaintiff submitted evidence establishing that Spillman maintained an interactive website which marketed and made its products available to New York customers, provided for custom designs tailored to the needs of the purchaser, and highlighted its prior sales to New York and other interstate customers. Plaintiff also relied on affidavits submitted by Spillman to argue that Spillman derives substantial revenue from goods used or consumed in the state or from interstate commerce, and that it should have reasonably expected that the design, creation, supply, and distribution of the nesting diagram that accompanied its bridge forms could have consequences in this state. Specifically, one affidavit established that Spillman was aware that its bridge forms were used over and over again by precast companies at different sites, that the average useful lifespan of a bridge form could be up to 25 years, and that the bridge forms would be repeatedly transported. Another affidavit established that Spillman sells its products and goods, including bridge forms, to purchasers located throughout the United States, and that in 2016, New York sales amounted to $277,000, and in 2017, sales had so far amounted to $219,000, which at that point constituted 3.1% of its total sales. Viewing the facts in the light most favorable to plaintiff as the non-moving party, we agree with Supreme Court that the foregoing provided the sufficient start required to warrant further discovery on the issue of whether personal jurisdiction may be properly exercised over Spillman under CPLR 302A3, while also comporting with federal due process requirements. In Buchan, on page 22, the Second Department held that the failure to comply with the service directions in the order to show cause deprived Supreme Court of jurisdiction over the proceeding. As the court put it, the service requirements set forth in the order to show cause were jurisdictional in nature. The plaintiff's undisputed failure to comply with these requirements by serving the order to show cause pursuant to CPLR 308-4 instead of CPLR 311-A deprived the Supreme Court of jurisdiction to entertain the plaintiff's order to show cause. In Matter of Stephen and Mark, on page 22, the First Department held that the case must be dismissed for failure to include a necessary party because the statute of limitations had run. The court said, petitioner's failure to join as a party the condominium board, which installed the backflow prevention device in dispute, constitutes a failure to join a necessary party. Since the applicable statutory period has expired and the condominium board can no longer be joined, and proceeding in its absence would potentially be highly prejudicial to it, the proper remedy is dismissal of the proceeding rather than a joinder of the condominium board. But there's a more recent case that made it clear that the court has the power to summon the necessary party as long as the party is within the jurisdiction of the court. That's Deutsche Bank Natural Trust Company versus Bandalos, B-A-N-D-A-L-O-S. It's a 2019 New York Slip Opinion, 05106, 2nd Department, 62619. Again, that's Slip Opinion. 2019 New York Slip Opinion, 05106, 2nd Department, 62619. And there, the statute had run, and the court, pursuant to CPLR 1000B, summoned the necessary party itself. In Avalon Auto on page 26, addressing claim preclusion or res judicata, the First Department held that the fact that plaintiffs could have intervened in a federal action did not trigger the res judicata doctrine in a subsequent state action. As the court explained it, there is no legal doctrine that would compel plaintiffs to litigate in the federal action. Plaintiffs, as non-parties to the federal litigation, are not precluded from asserting claims that no party in the federal litigation had standing to pursue. To hold otherwise would mean that a debtor may, by suing parties other than the creditor, require the creditor to participate in the action or have its claims precluded. In Kaufman, on page 31, addressing a court's power to limit vexatious litigation, the Second Department held Supreme Court properly dismissed the pro se plaintiff's legal malpractice action and properly limited plaintiff's ability to file additional motions. The court said, although a pro se litigant is afforded some latitude, he or she is not entitled to rights greater than any other litigant and may not disregard court rules or deprive an adversary of rights normally enjoyed by an opposing party. Accordingly, when a litigant is abusing the judicial process by harassing individuals solely out of ill will or spite, equity may enjoin such vexatious litigation. Here, the plaintiff's pattern of vexatious and duplicative motion practice warranted the modest limitation of directing the plaintiff to bring future motions via order to show cause. Okay, so that concludes this one-half hour, one-half credit CLE, which is based on the summaries of decisions released in January 2019, the decisions that relate in some way to civil procedure, and they're drawn from the summaries of the decisions posted on the New York Appellate Digest website and compiled and organized in the January 2019 Civil Procedure Update Pamphlet.